Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. The following talk by philosopher Nick Bostrom of Oxford University was delivered at Yale University on June 28, 2003 at the Transvision Conference on Transhumanist Bioethics, sponsored by the World Transhumanist Association.
I'd like to welcome everyone to the next session here. This session is on transhumanist bioethics. My name is Mike Treader. I'm the Executive Director of the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology, a policy think tank in New York City. I'm also a co-founder of the New York Transhumanist Association, so I'm putting a pitch out to anybody who lives in the New York area. If you'd like to continue these sort of meetings on a local level, please let me know. Our first speaker this afternoon is a British Academy postdoctoral fellow and a member of the philosophy faculty at Oxford University. In 1998, he co-founded the World Transhumanist Association. He currently serves as WTA chairman of the board and is a frequent spokesperson and commentator in the media. His research interests are in philosophy of science, probability theory, and the ethical and strategic implications of anticipated technologies such as artificial intelligence, genetic engineering, and nanotechnology. He has a background in cosmology, computational neuroscience, mathematical logic, philosophy, and artificial intelligence. And he's the author of the book Anthropic Bias: Observation Selection Effects in Science and Philosophy. Please welcome Dr. Nick Bostrom.
Thank you, Mike. Well, you've probably all noticed that in discussions about bioethics, about the use of human enhancement technologies, cloning, public policy related to technology, very soon in these discussions, the concept of human nature comes up. And a variety of related concepts like human dignity, or what is natural and appropriate for us humans to do, the concept of dehumanization and the undermining of our humanity. Now, I think that these concepts are very blunt conceptual tools to do analysis with. They often lend themselves more to rhetoric than to careful thinking about exactly what is at stake. Nevertheless, since the language that that people who are opposed to these technologies use often involve these concepts, these terms, I think if we actually want to engage in that discourse, we too need to have something to say about what human nature is and what human dignity is, and about how that is related to what's morally right and appropriate for us to do. So the little paper here that I'm going to present sort of an extract from today is a work in progress, which proposes to lay out a transhumanist view of human nature and of human dignity. If you have a view of human nature and you want to ground moral arguments by appealing to human nature, you ought to be able to answer a range of different questions, such as, you know, are we less human today than our hunter-gatherer ancestors of 100,000 years ago? That's a kind of strange question. A lot of people wouldn't know really what to say about that. But that's, I mean, if you are so unclear about what you mean when you appeal to human nature that you're sort of puzzled by something like that, then I think you have more thinking to do. So some people might say that now we are no more and no less human than our ancestors in the Pleistocene, because there is some unchanging human essence that they had and that we have and that hasn't altered or changed at all during these 100,000 years. So just look at two possible candidates for what such an unchanging human essence could be as examples of a wider class of proposals. Some people might think our genetic constitution, that's our unchanging essence. Now, one thing we know about our genetic constitution, of course, and we have known ever since Darwin, is that it changes. It changes over a large timescale. It's true that our genetic constitution today is not all that different from what it was, say, 50,000 years ago. On the other hand, it's also not that very different from the genetic constitution of, say, chimpanzees, with whom we share more than 98% of our DNA. So what that tells us, of course, is that a small change in our genetic constitution can make a big difference. 2% can make the difference between a chimp and a human. So the first point there is that even over time scales such as 50,000 or 100,000 years, there might be small genetic changes that, even though they're small percentage-wise, might still have important implications and effects on what we are. But there is a more fundamental point, which is that we are not just our genes. Our genes in isolation does not make for a human race, a human in a sort of an isolated room, you know, without contact with society and other people and so forth. And you get nothing that sort of, you know, reminds us of what we think of as being human. We are rather our phenotypes, which is the result of the interaction of our genes with the environment. Our environment has changed radically in the past 50,000 years, of course. So if this is our concept of humanity, then humanity also has changed. We live very different lives today than our hunter-gatherer did, ancestors did. We read and write, we wear clothes, we live in cities, we earn money and buy food from the supermarket, call people on the telephone, watch television, read newspapers, drive cars, file taxes, vote in national elections. Women give birth in hospitals. Life expectancy is about 3 times longer. We know that the Earth is round and that stars are large gas clouds that are lit from the inside by nuclear fusion, and that the universe is about 13.7 billion years old and very big, perhaps infinite. The combination of all these differences, I think, reflect not just superficial differences in what we are, but it's actually that our human nature, in important respects, has changed. Another candidate for some unchanging human essence might be our capacity for rational thinking. So, you know, our hunter-gatherer ancestors could talk and they would have some ability to reason abstractly, so maybe that's the constant. If you look more closely at this, I think that our capacity for rational thinking has also changed in this time interval, changed radically, because it depends not only on the gross macroscopic organization of the brain, of course, but on the fine structure of the brain, which changes on a minute-per-minute basis in all of us. And we now have much better tools for programming this fine structure of our brains, tools such as books, papers, databases, other people that know more, get a lot of information from that. These things affect us physiologically. Now, a sufficiently advanced neuroscientist could actually, you know, in principle, be able to see the effect of these things by looking closely at our brains. And they, of course, radically affect our behavior, our beliefs, our values, you know, and so forth. Also, on a more sort of social level, we have, you know, memes, critical thinking skills, scientific methods, and so forth. This can also be viewed as different ways of programming the fine structure of our brains and therefore changing who we are, even on a physiological level. But this this point goes further. So it would be a mistake, I think, to see human nature as ending at the boundary of our skins. And to draw, I mean, for some purposes it's useful to separate an individual on the basis of where their skin ends, but if we really look at what we are as functional entities, it's quite artificial to make a huge distinction between whether you store a telephone number in your cortex or in a notebook that you always carry with you. It really amounts to pretty much the same thing. So you can add in notebooks, internet, calculators, and other tools and implements whereby our ability to perform mental computations and memory retention is enhanced. And other things that affect us indirectly, like eyeglasses, like a huge difference in terms of your capacity for rational thinking in an era where a lot of the information is coded as visual signs, and desks, coffee, you know. So the capacity for rational thinking has also changed radically in this time frame. It's not some unchanging human essence that that up to now has been unaltered and that we're now on the border of beginning to change. So, and a useful concept here is, rather than thinking of cyborgs as the sort of the most central concept here, cyborg being a human has certain physiological processes aided or controlled by mechanical or electronic devices like implants, to instead think of the concept of a fiborg, a functional cyborg, a term that was coined by futurist Alexander Chislenko. A cyborg is a biological organism functionally supplemented with technological extensions. If you think about it, we are all cyborgs. We are all deeply artificial beings. So here's a little self-test that he designed. This is just a couple of samples from that. You can check if they apply to you. I think I would check each one of these three. So I think that tells us something about what we take our nature to be. Human nature is more than the aggregate of human tissue. So, to put in the place of this static view of human nature, whereby we are defined in terms of some, you know, basically our DNA, a very reductionist approach, I think that a transhumanist view of human nature would be something along the lines of a dynamic concept, which is human nature not as unchanging, but as changing, that it has changed, is changing, and probably will continue to change. It's holistic in the sense it's more than just the sequence of our DNAs. It's the whole, in addition to the DNA, it's the environment we grow up in, it's other people, it's our technological infrastructure, it's the tools we use, our culture and so forth. All of that goes into making us who we are. It is not once and for all given by some external agent like God or Mother Nature, but it's partially human-made. What we are today, we are to a significant extent thanks to the contributions by all the people who lived before, who built up our civilizations. Without that, we would be very different. We would not be fully human in the modern sense. And finally, transhumanist view of human nature would see it as improvable. It kind of follows from the other three that if you think of human nature as having changed radically through, you know, the last 10,000 or 50,000 years, maybe the rate of change has been picking up. To think that right now, this particular time slice that we happen to occupy would somehow be the culmination of the best possible way human nature could ever be starts to sound radically implausible. I mean, it would require an enormously strong argument for such a surprising fact to be the case. One way to try to map out a little bit of the conceptual territory here is to think of humanity as being a prototype concept, so that different times and different cultures, when they say humanity and think of what a human is, might have a different prototypical humanity in mind, so that there might be a wide range of individuals who might also be human, but they might fit more or less well to what we think of as being typically, paradigmatically human. So if we think of ourselves as modern humans, or just humans for short, we can look back and we can see our Pleistocene ancestors, maybe going even further back before our humanoid ancestors really had language, as being pre-humans. Maybe from a biological point of view, they would still be belong to the human species, but they would be less paradigmatically human than we are. Looking forward, similarly, we can think of enhanced kinds of human individuals as being transhuman. So they might still be human, but they might be such that, given our current prototype of humanity, they might be less typical instances of what we think of as being human. They might sort of lack some of the characteristics that we associate with being human. And posthumans might be defined then as being so radically enhanced that they would no longer be human at all by everybody's current standards. One thing that kind of follows from this is that what prototypical humanity is, and whether you would be prototypically transhuman or prehuman or modern human, would also be relative to time and community. So if you had, you know, if a sort of ancient Babylonian had looked at us, they might well have doubted whether we were human at all. They might have thought that we were some sort of godlike creatures or freakish creatures of some sort. And there is indeed some anthropological evidence for this, that some technologically primitive cultures having come in contact with sort of modern man have indeed sort of concluded that they were probably some form of gods. So I think those perceptions will change after exposure, but the initial prototype that people have, I think, would classify modern humans as being less prototypically humans than their hunter-gatherer ancestor friends, if you ask the hunter-gatherer. And if you ask a transhuman, they might think of us as not being really fully human. I mean, we would be human, but sort of a primitive, pre-human kind of being. And posthumans might look back of us as sort of really lacking a lot of what it takes to be fully prototypically human. Some people think that, of course, we should resist changing human nature. And one very articulate spokesperson for that view is Leon Cass, who I will read one quote here. Most of the given bestowals of nature have their given species-specified natures. They are each and all of a given sort. Cockroaches and humans are equally bestowed, but differently natured. To turn a man into a cockroach, as we don't need Kafka to show us, would be dehumanizing. To try to turn a man into more than a man might be so as well. We need more than a general appreciation for nature's gifts. We need a particular regard and respect for the special gift that is our own given nature. This kind of reasoning does seem misguided in light of the kind of considerations that I've briefly outlined before. If whatever this given nature is something that we have made to a large extent, that has been changing and is changing, and that consists of our whole technological and social structure as well as our DNA, then it's really hard to see what to make of this kind of argument and this kind of thought at all. So I think it undermines one important line of objection against the transhumanist project. Perhaps more effectively than any very detailed cost-benefit analysis. Personally, I think that might be a more cognitively valid and useful thing to do, but in terms of actually engaging with people of opposite views, I think that you can do any number of cost-benefit analyses, but if you don't really engage with what is driving their thinking, which might be this view of an inviolable human nature that is static, then you're not really going to get much traction. So I won't go into why transhumanists would think that human nature can be improved. You're all familiar with most of those reasons. You can think of, if we imagine a space of possible modes of being, different kinds of lives, different ways of feeling, different ways of thinking, different ways of relating, and so forth. Only a small portion of this space of possible modes of beings is accessible by current modern humans, because we are constrained by our biological limitations and our technological limitations, no less than other animals are constrained by their limitations. A chimpanzee can't really have a human life because they lack certain biological structures that are necessary for that. Similarly, we can't have currently a post-human life or even a transhuman life because we die before we have time to mature sufficiently, our brains are not sufficiently developed, and so forth. We know that there are valuable modes of being inside this little human realm here, because we know that human life can be worth living. We have no grounds whatsoever for ruling out there couldn't also be very worthwhile modes of being in this larger space that would be accessible by post-humans. On the contrary, I would say that we have all reason to suppose that there might be extremely valuable and worthwhile modes of being out there that we can't currently access. And this possibility, that there could be such much better ways of being, constitutes a reason for us to develop the tools to enable us to go out and explore that larger space and search for those values. I think that's a core transhumanist value. A lot of the rest can follow from that. I won't go into this now, but I think it's important to distinguish being human from having moral status. These are two distinct concepts. They are related in different ways, but it's not necessarily the case that the higher degree you are human to, that the more moral status you have. And I think that's especially important if you move to this prototypical view of human nature, where some groups would be less human relative to the standards of another group. If you have that view of human nature, it's crucial to distinguish that from moral status. We cannot have the same moral status, even though being less paradigmatic examples of what we think of as being prototypically human. Finally, some words about human dignity. This is also a word that is much used in bioethical debates. And it has a lot of different meanings. Three of these meanings, I think, is dignity, human dignity in the sense of the inalienable right to be treated with a basic level of respect. There are just certain things you can't do to humans, sort of, you know, basic human rights. And then there is another sense in which it is related to the Kantian idea of dignity as deriving from our status as autonomous persons capable of rational self-determination and moral choice. And the third sense, quite different from the others, is human dignity as the quality of being worthy, honorable, morally noble, or excellent. So the way we should view different modifications depend on which of these three senses we're talking about. A lot of people say that changing human nature in different ways would undermine human dignity. If we're talking about human dignity in the first sense here, I think almost everybody would agree that it would not necessarily do that. If you have a human that has been transformed in different ways, even those who think that that would be degrading and dehumanizing would still agree that, provided they had a capacity for feeling pleasure and pain and could plan and be susceptible to moral reasoning, would still, have the right to be treated with basic respect. So that can't be the notion of dignity that is at place in objecting against the idea of modifying human nature. And similarly with the second one, there is no reason to think that an enhanced or modified human being would be less capable of making autonomous choices or moral choices or rational thinking. And I might be more capable of that, in fact. Cognitively enhanced being might be more capable of making their own choices about things. So it really comes down to the third notion of dignity, I think. Let's breeze through this, as it is the whole Brave New World thing, and which is often quoted as an instance of what's wrong with changing human nature. It will lead to Brave New World. I mean, without going into the details here, one thing to notice is that the people in Brave New World are not transhuman, let alone posthuman. Technology in Brave New World has not been used to expand human capacities, but on the contrary, to diminish them. So they have roughly normal health spans and health, but they have sort of a lower level of capacity for rational thinking. Most of them are even deliberately brain damaged, and they're also stunted emotionally and morally. So it's not a really good example to use, to judge whether, in this third sense of dignity, transhumans and posthumans would be undignified. If it's actually the case that something like the transhumanist picture is correct, that there might be transhumans and posthumans in the future, what does that make of the concept of dignity for us right now? Instead of the picture where human dignity is inherently threatened by every attempt for humans to take control of their own nature and undermined by this quest for mastery over ourselves, I think Pico della Mirandola, writing back in 1486, provided a more positive and, I think, transhumanist-friendly characterization of what our human dignity consists in. So I'll just read this, and that will be the end. "We have given you, O Adam, no visage proper to yourself, nor endowment properly your own, in order that whatever place, whatever form, whatever gifts you may with premeditation select, these same you may have and possess through your own judgment and decision. The nature of all other things is defined and restricted within laws which we have laid down. You, by contrast, impeded by no such restrictions, may by your own free will, to whose custody we have assigned you, trace for yourself the lineaments of your own nature. We have made you neither a creature of heaven nor of earth, neither mortal nor immortal, in order that you may, as a free and proud shaper of your own being, fashion yourself in the form you may prefer. It will be in your power to descend to the lower brutish forms of lives. You will be able, though, through your own decision, to rise again to the superior orders whose life is divine." So in a sense, I think an important part of our contemporary human dignity consists in exactly this ability to actually begin to reshape ourselves, and that's not a threat, but actually a constituent of modern human dignity. Thanks.
I want to read and comment on briefly this wonderful article that was published in the Village Voice by Eric Bard, Inside the Movement for Post-Human Rights. It's about the Transvision Conference, which recently completed. You can read the article at the Village Voice. It was in the July 30th issue. Once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form for any natural thing, but such a form as Grecian goldsmiths make of hammered gold and gold enameling. Yeats's wish, expressed in his poem Sailing to Byzantium, was a governing principle for those attending the World Transhumanist Association Conference at Yale University in late June. International academics and activists, they met to lay the groundwork for a society that would admit as citizens and companions intelligent robots, cyborgs made from a free mixing of human and machine parts, and fully organic, genetically engineered people who aren't necessarily human at all. A good many of these 160 thinkers aspire to immortality and omniscience through uploading human consciousness into ever-evolving machines. The three-day gathering was hosted by an entity no less reputable than the Yale Interdisciplinary Bioethics Project's Working Research Group on Technology and Ethics. The World Transhumanist Association chairman and co-founder is Oxford University philosopher Nick Bostrom. Dismiss it as Star Trek convention by another name, and you would miss out on the culmination of the Western experiment in rights and reason. The opening debate, should humans welcome or resist becoming post-human, raised a question that seemed impossibly far over the horizon in an era when the idea of reproductive cloning remains controversial. Yet the back and forth felt oddly perfunctory. Boston University bioethicist George Annis denounced the urge to alter the species, but the response from the audience revealed a community of people who feel the inevitability of revolution in their bones. Quote, "It's like arguing in favor of the plow. You know some people are going to argue against it, but you also know it's going to exist," says James Hughes, secretary of the Transhumanist Association and a sociologist teaching at Trinity College in Connecticut. "We used to be a subculture, and now we're becoming a movement. A movement taken seriously enough that it's already under attack." Hughes cites the anti-technologist Unabomber as a member of the BioLuddite camp, though an extremist one. Quote, "I think that if in the future the technology of human enhancement is forbidden by BioLuddites through government legislation, or if they terrorize people into having no access to those technologies, that becomes a fundamental civil rights struggle. Then there might come a time for the legitimate use of violence in self-defense," he says. "But long before that, there will be a black market and underground network in place. Should a fully realized form of artificial intelligence become in some manner enslaved," Hughes says, "that would call for liberation acts, not breaking into labs, but whatever we can do." Now, I just want to say, I did kind of say that, but I did not imply that we were preparing for armed revolution. I just merely said that just like abortion rights doctors have a right to carry arms to defend themselves against violent attacks by right-to-lifers, that if someone started to come after doctors who were providing enhancement, human enhancement services, that they would also have a right to self-defense. But that all the violence that has so far been committed by the Animal Liberation Front, the right-to-lifers, and by the Unabomber has been coming from the BioLuddites and not at all from the transhumanist side. So just wanted to set that clear for my faithful listeners. I am not the John Brown of our age, although we can talk about when the situations do arise, when what the legitimate grounds for self-defense are. Peace out. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.